from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. During its 12 seasons on the air, my three sons champion family values as it's, I knew I was going to screw that up, as it spanned the ever-changing decade of the 60s. It turned movie star Fred McMurray into everyone's image of the ideal TV dad and became one of the most fondly remembered series of its type. Several members of the cast and creative team reunited on June 19th, 2010 at the Paley Center for Media in Los Angeles to talk about My Three Sons and the 50th anniversary celebration of such. And an old friend of the program here, Stan Livingston, who played Chip Douglas on the show, is with us. Hi there, sir.
Hey, Dana. How are you?
I'm great. Nice to have you back on the show. You know, I remember the show, and I watched it live. So it's hard to believe. 50 years. Wow.
Yeah, that really is something that something could have that kind of longevity. Of course, we're giving our ages away when we say that now. But at least I can ask people, did you see it in first run, syndication, on Nickelodeon, or TV Land? So we've got about four generations of people now have been watching the show for 50 years.
Well, I watched it when there were only three TV channels to choose from. So
yeah, that was a different world. That was before cable. Yeah, in those days, we were pulling down audiences of 60, 80 million people a week, you know, watching a show back then.
I was just going to say that. See, that's the good interview that you are, sir. I was going to say, now compared your ratings to let's American Idol, you guys used to beat American Idol.
Oh, we'd kick their butts.
You know, one of the things, and I always do that. When I try to read something, I screw it up. It's better I just go impromptu. But one of the things about My Three Sons was family values. And when you sit back and you look at television then, and I could rattle off four or five or six or ten different series that were on during that time, compared to what's on today, comparing the two eras, there is no comparison, and just TV isn't like it used to be. For someone who's been in the business as long as you have been, sir, let's go back to 1960 and compare it to 2010.
Well, we certainly personified family values. I think, you know, the values that came out of the 50s and, you know, after World War II, you know, people settled down, wanted to raise families. And, you know, but a lot of it had to do TV. I don't want to say it was new, but it was relatively new by 1960 when My Three Sons came on. And, you know, it came out of a restrictive era as to what you could do. You know, prior to that, there was the Hays Commission in the movie industry that sort of dictated morals that were, you know, shown on the screen as to how long a person could kiss, or, you know, two people couldn't get into the same bed. None of that was ever shown. Even on Ozzie and Harriet, they had twin beds.
Right.
As people did on My Three Sons. Hey, My Three Sons, we never even had a toilet in our bathroom. You watch all those bathroom scenes. We got a shower, we got a bathtub and a sink, but no toilet.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, it was a different era. And, you know, I think the values that were portrayed in those stories, though, really kind of struck a chord with audiences. And, you know, life itself may not have been quite as pristine as it was on My Three Sons. And, you know, it was the life we all kind of longed for and the family we all kind of longed for. And certainly Steve Douglas, Fred McMurray, was the dad we all wanted.
Absolutely, and that explains a lot now. If you had no toilet, no wonder Uncle Charlie and Bub were so cranky all the time.
Oh, absolutely. Imagine holding it for 12 years.
Stan Livingston's here, and we're talking about the 50th anniversary celebration of My Three Sons. Fred McMurray, you go back to the classics, the movies, watch them on Turner Classic Movies or American Movie Classics. He played a bad guy quite a bit, and, you know, you can set aside the Disney movies, the tennis shoes and all that. How difficult was it for Fred McMurray to, from the public's perception, to go from that tough guy, bad guy in the movies to everyone's favorite father?
Well, you know, probably wasn't that tough as an actor. Actually, Fred really kind of had, kind of a dual career. I mean, he was, I mean, the consummate actor in that he could segue from doing light comedy, you know, The Egg and I, The Shaggy Dog, or he could play a heavy, you know, as you saw him in The Caine Mutiny or going way back, Double Indemnity, or The Apartment. You know, he certainly was a heel in that, if not a bad guy. And, you know, but he was an actor that could do that very easily. So coming to My Three Sons, I think the tough part probably for him, although I don't think that was evident to the audience either, is how little he actually was there on the set and worked on the show. His contract dictated that all his scenes had to be shot in 45 days. So you're basically talking about a couple months' worth of work for Fred during the year, and the other 8 months we would do all the scenes without him. But that was never detected, I think, by the audience. And such a great actor, you know, that he could just come in and fill those shoes and, you know, be the guy we all came to love on My Three Sons.
You know, I watched some of the video from the Paley Center online, and it was funny to see, and it's also fascinating as far as how the filming went. Tina Cole had a great segment where she talked about being, you know, pregnant in one scene, having the babies in the next scene, where you would shoot it in segments. A lot of people don't understand the daily filming of a TV series. You could, you know, be filming the last episode and later on be filming the second episode all in the same week or month. And it's, was that ever confusing for you as a kid?
Not really. And I mean, you know, if you're familiar with production on both sides of the camera, as I am, because I work as a producer director as well now, that nothing really is ever shot in order. It's not like a play where you start at the beginning, go to the end. Our show, though, you know, what you would do is you would always, in preparation for the show, you would have actors who were going to be there certain days. So you would have to shoot all their scenes, even if it was out of order, or if you had a particular set that you needed to get out of there, what they call a swing set. You would shoot all the scenes on that set, even if one was at the beginning of the show, the middle of the show, and the end. They would just shoot it out so they could get rid of it and build the next set. So that's always going on, even today. But we were sort of the extreme of that because of Fred's participation in the show. The show was really created around and for Fred. You know, I'm sure people our age know who Fred McMurray is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was a big, big movie star. You know, the lesser, I guess he's known to the newer generations. But, you know, I always have to put things in perspective when I talk to audiences or talk to people about the show and tell them, look, when Fred McMurray came to TV, it was unheard of mm-hmm. that a movie star of that caliber was going to do the daily grind of a TV show and, you know, work in every single scene 8 to 10 hours a day for 2 months like that. And to put it in perspective, it would be like me telling an audience now, guess what? We've got a show called My Three Sons, and guess who the star is? It's Tom Cruise. You know, because that's
yes.
how big that was in 1960. And, yeah, that kind of, I think, puts it more into perspective for younger audiences. You know, it would just be the impact of Tom Cruise doing a TV series, which I'm sure he's not going to do, would just be overwhelming, you know, both with the networks and the audience reaction to it. It was the same in 1960 when Fred McMurray came to do this show, and they were, you know, as accommodating as they possibly could to make his life easier. What had happened, actually, he had adopted a pair of girls' twins, Katie and Laurie McMurray, and they were probably about 3-4 years old, and he just didn't want to go on the road. You know, he thought of himself as a family man and mm-hmm. and liked the show probably because it portrayed that type of person, and he wanted to be around L.A. while, you know, it could instead of going off to Timbuktu to do a movie, you know, you shoot for 8 hours a day, drive home, and you got to have, you know, you have time with your kids.
Yeah, it's how cool was it growing up 12 years, you know, filming at Desilu for a period, you and your brother, I'm sure you met lots of celebrities, saw lots of things. You had some, even had some fun throwing some film canisters to annoy some other people. Share that story with us.
Oh, well, right next door to us. Well, on the lot, there were a lot of shows that were great shows out of that era. We had Hogan's Heroes shooting there, Star Trek. Next door was The Lucy Show, not I Love Lucy, but the show that came later known as The Lucy Show. Ben Casey was still shooting there. Untouchables, the last couple of seasons were being done there. All kinds of shows. I mean, every year we'd come back and there'd be new people. Anyway, right next door to us was the Lucy Show, and it's probably a little bit of a motion picture TV legend how Bill Frawley and Vivian Vance didn't really care for one another, to put it euphemistically. Bill was always kind of trying, being the agitator that he was either yelling stuff at her or kind of pulling pranks on her. And anyway, he rolled my brother and I one time into gathering up. Right across from us, our particular soundstage was editorial, and out in the trash can were these huge, they were cans that they would put the film reels in, and they were just made from aluminum, and some of them might have been, you know, 2.5 feet in diameter, and I don't know, every once in a while we'd get out there and play with them, but they're just made a racket. So he had us gather up about 25, 30 of these cans, and we put them all in a box, and we snuck into the stage, and we stood there waiting to see what Bill was going to have us do. He goes, all right, as soon as you hear her speak, throw that box up in the air and just let those cans go. So we waited and waited, and finally we heard, you know, Vivian's voice. She had a line. They were rehearsing something, and Bill just, you know, had us turn the box over, and all of a sudden there was just this calamity that you could not believe how loud it was. You know, 25, 30 of these cans were rolling around and spinning and crashing into each other. It was like cymbals, and I think he knew, you know, she immediately knew it was Bill pulling a prank because we heard this voice off in the background. So there was all time stuff like that going on between the two of them, and some of it, I, you know, I've heard that it was real, but having, you know, thought about it a lot, I think they might have actually liked each other, and this was something they just sparred with each other on the set a little bit and saw that, you know, people kind of enjoyed that and just kind of took it to the limit, and I don't know how real it really was other than for other people's enjoyment.
Stan Livingston's here. We're talking about My Three Sons and the 50th anniversary celebration that was recently held June 19th. And if you want to check out some clips of that, just click on the link in the show notes. Working with your brother, you know, when you're growing up sometimes, you know, I watch my own kids and I think of my sister growing up. Sometimes when you're young, you don't like each other. How difficult was it working with Barry? And I had to laugh when I saw some of the clips. That's one of the few times I've actually seen him without his ball cap on.
Yeah, really. Yeah, he takes to wearing that, especially these days. Well, you know what? We got along great as brothers, I have to say. We probably had more fictional fights on My Three Sons than we did in real life. You know, we were really vying for each other's parts, you know, as actors. You know, we both worked before My Three Sons and during My Three Sons and even after, but we're such different-looking people and personalities, and especially back then, you know, I'm 3 years older than Barry, so... Yeah. You know, he just was a tiny little guy, and, you know, he wore glasses and had the buck teeth, and I was kind of the blonde towhead. So we were never really up to the same parts, and so we were always rooting for each other. And, you know, it was really kind of, a great thing that, I mean, I was sorry to see Tim Considine leave the show as the older brother, but my real brother was already playing, or, you know, the part of Ernie, who was just a neighborhood kid, and gave him the opportunity to come on the show full-time, and we were called My Three Sons, and Tim left, and all of a sudden we were down to two sons, so it was one of these cases in showbiz where nepotism paid off. So he had a shoe in on becoming the third son. They concocted some story. He was a foster kid, and his parents were leaving the country, and you couldn't take foster kids out of the country, so the Douglas household did him the favor of adopting him, and if you missed that one episode, you probably didn't know what the hell happened, how this guy got in there.
Bill Demarest, let's talk about him a bit.
He was great. You know, Bill was, you know, the consummate, if you look back on his career, you know, and at the time, he came on to My Three Sons, which was to replace, basically, Bill Frawley, who had gotten older and ill, and they couldn't get him insured, so he didn't come back. I think it was for the fourth season or fifth season, I forget which one it was now, and was replaced by Bill Demarest, and you know, I was so close to Bill Frawley. He was kind of the grandfather I never really had, and I enjoyed him from I Love Lucy. I remember playing hooky so I could watch I Love Lucy. And so to see him depart and be replaced by this other guy who I didn't even know, you know, as a kid, you know, it's kind of like a sibling and or a brother, and all of a sudden your mom dies and you got a new stepmom there. And, you know, it took me a while to warm up to Bill, you know, just because you're a kid and you just don't understand that stuff. But, you know, eventually I came to love Bill Demarest as much as I did Bill Frawley. But, you know, looking at it from purely an objective standpoint, looking at his career, I mean, Bill Demarest is the one who really had the huge, huge career.
You bet.
In the motion picture industry, and he was probably the quintessential second banana. I mean, if you look back, you know, he's always the best friend of the lead actor, the, you know, the villain, or you know, he was the second banana his whole life, but in very, very, you know, all the Preston Sturges films, films with William Bendix. I mean, just, you know, going back to the jazz singer. And I, at that time, you know, when I was 13, 14, I didn't realize, you know, what a big career he had. And it wasn't until later that I realized, holy smoke, this guy is huge. He's huge.
And that's the interesting part, and we talked about it a little bit earlier, the high-quality movie stars that went into television, you would never see that today. The typecasting, Stan, you and I have talked about this before, you know, the child star thing and how you're typecast. You know, poor Gary Coleman just passed on here not that long ago, a sad story. But did you see that with yourself, with your brother?
Yeah, I did. I did. And unfortunately, it was a different mindset back then in the minds of the casting people, too. I mean, basically, if you had become a commodity or a star on TV, you're almost precluded from having a career in the movie industry. The people that cast those, you know, the films really didn't want to see you. You know, they wanted people that they felt, you know, were starting their careers as movie actors. And there was this invisible wall there, you know. So really, the people that moved on from TV a lot of times were just doing B-movies or that type of thing. Where, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, these people, it's like Friends and the people on, you know, some of the other shows that are on TV even today, you know, you see them segueing into the movie industry. Because, you know, it was kind of foolhardy what they did, because you realize, hey, if you're on a show and it's 12 years old and you got 80 million people watching you every week, even if you only brought a portion of that to the movie industry, you know, to come see you in a film, that would be huge.
Yeah.
And back then, there was just this caste system that, you know, you kind of had a hierarchy. And if you're a TV actor, you know, the most you're going to be able to do is star in a TV show, and you weren't really going to make that transition. It's very, very difficult. Very few people that I know have made it. Jodie Foster, maybe. Kurt Russell comes to mind. Mm-hmm. But when you think of the tens of thousands of kid actors out of that era, you know, where are they, or who are they now, or where are they now? I mean, you know, maybe I didn't make it into the movie industry as a movie actor on that level, but, you know, still being involved in the industry 50 years later, as opposed to not being in it at all, is... You know, I'm appreciative of that.
Well, longevity is important, and you and your brother have been able to survive. I'm going to try this one more time. During its 12 seasons on the air, My Three Sons championed family values as it spanned the ever-changing decade of the 60s. And it turned movie star Fred McMurray into everyone's image of the ideal TV dad. I think that's better, isn't it, Stan?
Yeah, that's kind of it. And, you know, you always wonder what Fred would have thought, because he did all those great films. He was probably in 80 to 100 feature films. And, you know, but anything you read about Fred McMurray, if it's biographical material now, always, you know, just points right to My Three Sons, almost like he never had a movie career.
Yeah.
So you got to be careful what you get involved in.
Yeah, that's a head-scratcher for sure.
He was a great guy, and like I said, taught me some great lessons, and I'm still friends with, you know, everybody on the show. Well, obviously my brother, but Don Grady, it's like an older brother. Tim, I see him quite often. He's like another older brother to me. Tina, I see every so often. She doesn't live in L.A. Mm-hmm. A little more difficult seeing her. And then Fred, you know, until he passed away, we were, you know, good friends, and I'm still friends with the producer. In fact, he was at the show. I talked him into showing up for the Paley event, and he's a great guy, and he's a guy that knows all the stories behind the scenes, so he was a great addition to have. And actually, at this event, Ronnie Troop came. She was the woman who played Polly, my wife, on the show, and I hadn't seen her in 32 years.
Wow.
Yeah, we did a reunion show, I believe, for Dick Clark back in 1977, 78, and that was the last time I saw Ronnie Troop.
And that Bobby Troop's daughter?
That's Bobby Troop's daughter, yeah. And her stepmom was Julie London.
Julie London, who was married to Jack Webb and Dragnet and all that stuff.
In fact, ironic, the guy who produced the show, Don Federson, his production offices were in the old Jack Webb offices at CBS.
Wow.
Pretty strange. Everything was, what is it, 7 degrees of separation or something.
Yeah. That's the difference. I'm going to end up with this in today's television to shows like My Three Sons. When you watch My Three Sons, even today, you can walk away from the episode feeling good. When you watch television today, you walk away feeling like you need some Rolaids or something. I don't know.
Or maybe getting a muzzle for your kids. I don't know.
Exactly. TV's not like it used to be, but thank God for reruns. And I appreciate you coming on, Stan. You're always welcome here, sir.
Thanks so much. I appreciate Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye now.
That's Stan Livingston. Remember My Three Sons? Na, 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 na. It was a great show, and I wanted to start with something fun tonight here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with clinical psychiatrist Dr. Dale Archer, and he and I are going to analyze the brain of your Anne Vandersloot. Is that amazing or what? I actually found a thimble somewhere that we could pop it into, and we're going to analyze it. I use an analogy. We taped the interview about 3 or 4 hours ago, and I used an analogy of the old TV commercial. Do you remember with the guy with the egg? This is your brain, and then he cracks the egg and puts it into the hot frying pan, and this is your brain on drugs. Kind of a dumb analogy on my part, but I was anyway. You'll see how I feed into it. After that, you know her, you love her, you can't live without her. NBC News analyst Robin Sachs will be here to talk more on Vandersloot, and then we'll finish off the show with T.J. Ward. You know him as a private investigator who worked for the Holloway family in the search for Natalie Holloway. So stay tuned. There's lots more to come here on the Dana Pretzer Show. Okay, we're back. My next guest and I consider to be in what's called the old fart category. And we'll remember a television commercial from many years back where you saw a hot frying pan on the stove and a guy holding an egg, and he would say, and he'd show the egg to the camera, and he'd say, this is your brain, and then he'd crack it open, and he'd put it into the hot frying pan, and be sizzling away, and then he'd say, and this is your brain on drugs. So what I want to do tonight is not cook eggs with my next guest. I want to talk to him about Joran Vandersloot, and let's take Joran Vandersloot's brain, let's assume it's about the size of a thimble. And we can take Mr. Vandersloot's brain and we can put it into that thimble. I want to talk a little bit with my next guest about that brain, that thimble, and what he thinks. You'll know Dr. Dale Archer as a Fox News contributor, a clinical psychiatrist. When I look on his website, drdalearcher.com, you'll see questions like this. Should I marry a man I don't trust? I'm not sure if it's Dale asking that question about himself or not. My daughter is frightened to sleep alone. My life is never dull. Not always fun, but never dull. And did I find Mr. Wrong via a online dating service? And I'm making fun about that a little bit. I'm not sure if that's is that you asking those questions, or is that some of your listeners or viewers?
No, the questions actually are under the category "Tell me your story. I think I can help."
Right.
So I take questions every day from individuals that write in, and we pick the best, and I answer them, and we post it up on the website.
Yeah, it's great. And all those questions are questions I'm sure you hear every day. But the question I'm going to ask you right now is not, should I marry a man I don't trust, seeing I am a man and I have a wife? That would be a problem.
Yeah.
You're Anne Vandersloot. All the cable news coverage, you name it, from soup to nuts, that's another old saying that you and I will recognize. You even get the guy that saw Joran Vandersloot on the street corner, and everyone says he's a narcissist. He's a sociopath. Joran Vandersloot's mailman will say Joran Vandersloot's a narcissist and a sociopath. But I don't think any of these people really understand what those terms mean.
No, and I'm glad that we're talking about that and not about the frying pan and the egg, because I really didn't know where you were going. What show am I talking on again?
Yeah, that's right. It's a visual analogy on the radio, and I guess it didn't work worth a damn, did it?
No, I didn't work very well, but I was thinking that we were going to be starting in on the war on drugs and just say no.
Yeah, no.
I was wrong, but no, I thought it was a good analogy. You know, I think Joran Vandersloot is a case study. I mean,
yeah.
I think that every individual who kills has a motive. I mean, the most common motives, money, power, revenge, sometimes love and infidelity. But I think Joran did it for a completely different reason. I think he is primarily a narcissist, and even more importantly, he is addicted to fame.
Right.
And my read on the entire scenario is that Natalie Holloway, whether you believe he was involved or not, was an accident. And after that happened, he garnered so much notoriety, so much media attention, and he absolutely thrived on it. He loved it. And if you notice that every time that case started to die out in the media, he would come forward with a bizarre statement.
Yep.
I know where the body is. Oh, she was sold into sex slavery. I know who did it, and I can prove it. And the spotlight would ratchet up again. He'd be right there front and center, and this would go on and on and on. And I think after 5 years, he basically got to the point where he wasn't getting the fix from it that he was before because it was old, and he ended up killing again.
Dr. Dale Archer's here, and we're talking about Joran Vandersloot and something about cooking eggs. No, I'll get off that. I'll get off that. Vandersloot, and I've said it before, suffers from a raging case of OJ-itis. And you're right. He loves the media. He loves the attention. And he's played several media outlets like a cheap violin. As soon as he wants attention, he throws out the bait, and they grab it, and away we go. We've heard, again, those terms, narcissist and sociopath, but we've also heard the term maniac, serial killer maniac, or things like that. I've discussed it on the show several times with several guests. I don't think he's a serial killer. He may be a serial rapist, but again, someone who kills to bring attention to himself, or he just snapped, whether it was a robbery, whether it was drugs, whether it was whatever. But now he's getting that attention again, and I want to ask you, Doc, now that he's in a little bit more trouble than he was in Aruba, obviously, is he still thriving off the attention that he was the way that he did in Aruba?
Absolutely, he is. And I think just to give quick definitions of the terms, because a lot of people don't know what those things are. A serial killer, by definition, you have to kill three separate people, and there has to be a cooling off period after each one. So he really wouldn't meet that definition unless there's someone else out there that we don't know about. But I agree with you. I don't think he's a serial killer. In terms of a sociopath, that's someone who has no regards for the rules of society and only does what they do because it benefits them in some way, shape, or form. And, of course, a narcissist is a milder form of sociopath. But I think that he is absolutely getting the same rush right now from playing this Stephanie Flores murder, just like he did the Natalie Holloway murder. And I give his evidence the fact that he confessed and then less than a week later said, oh, it was coerced and they made me sign it. I didn't know what I was signing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just playing the game once again. And then, oh, I'm going to file charges against them for false imprisonment. And it just goes on and on and on. And I think that he is going to turn this into the biggest media circus since OJ, and perhaps even bigger than OJ because it's going to be worldwide. And I think he can play this game for a long, long time. And he's always got the trump card in his back pocket. If things get too tough, that if you transfer me to Aruba, I'm going to cop to the Natalie Holloway murder, and he gets out of South America and to a friendly environment.
No, you're right. And if you're just tuning in, Dr. Dale Archer's here. He's a clinical psychiatrist, has the fantastic program, the Dr. Dale Archer Show. You see him on Fox News. You hear him on my show occasionally. And we're analyzing Joran Vandersloot. Let's talk about the family of Vandersloot. Anita Paulus died here a while ago. They went through the same media attention, initially protecting their son, and now the mother comes out and makes comments like he's sick in the head. He had to leave Aruba to go to Peru to avoid being committed to a mental facility. It sounds to me, and other analysts that I've had on the program, Doc, have said this is a beginning of a insanity defense for Mr. Vandersloot, and they're going to use the media to their advantage. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, your mom is not going to be someone who is going to get an insanity defense for you, because to get an insanity defense, of course, at the time, you cannot know the difference between right or wrong, and that only occurs with psychiatric conditions that are the worst of the worst. For an individual to be able to travel around South America on his own and at the same time have a severe mental problem, such as schizophrenia, which is the most common condition when we're dealing with an insanity defense,
right,
is just in no way, shape, or form, in my mind, going to fly. But I think in terms of explaining the mom's behavior, that it's very, very simple. As a parent, we always think the best of our children. We want the best for them, and we give them the benefit of the doubt. At some point, though, in this case, it finally hit the mom that Joran is not a good person. He was down there. He confessed to a murder. And all of the benefit of the doubt that I've been giving him all this time has clearly not been deserved. But the parent also wants something to blame everything on. And what better to say, my son's a good boy, but he's sick in the head. He has a mental problem. And if that would be addressed, then he never would have done what he did.
Dr. Dale Archer's here. Let's talk about the Holloway family now. Obviously, they're watching all of this. They're watching it very closely. They've been jerked around by this jerk Vandersloot now for 5 years. I still say that the confession in the vehicle, the hidden camera confession where he was smoking dope and talking about how Natalie died and what he did with her is probably the most accurate, but who knows? But the Holloway family themselves have to be, because you want to bring your daughter home and you want to give her the proper burial and try and get on with your life, but they see this idiot sitting back and doing what he can to bring attention to himself. But the Holloway family can't give up hope that maybe someday he will have a scintilla, whatever that word means, of decency and say where Natalie is and if she can actually be recovered. If you were giving advice to the Holloway family right now, what would that be?
Well, I would say that at this point in time, you have to let the justice system down in Peru play out.
Yeah.
I firmly believe that he knows something about the Holloway case. Mm-hmm. And I also firmly believe that he is going to save that as his trump card to play when he needs it, probably at the end of the legal trial down in Peru. So I think at this point, there's really nothing they can do to try to rush this along. And all I can tell them is, look, he's on trial for another murder. Certainly he needs to be tried for that. And if found guilty, he needs to be punished for that. And we're going to do everything we can in order to try to get this information from him. But now is not the time or the place. And there's no motivation whatsoever for him to talk right now.
Yeah.
But I think down the road, there will be. So I would just advise them to be very, very patient and to let the Peruvian authorities do their thing.
And you and I both know that the networks, apparently already the mother has been fronted $100,000 to do an interview. The networks are all over this. Hell, if I had a chance to interview Joran, I'd do it. But on the other hand, is the media wrong for paying attention to him? You know, I use John Mark Carr as an example, O.J. Simpson as an example, those that feed off the media, these scumbags, but the media just grabbing onto the story and running with it and running with it and running with it, and then a lot of stories aren't being told because of all the time being spent on these characters. Is the media wrong for covering it as much as they've been doing?
You know, that, obviously that's a difficult question, and because I'm involved in a lot of that commentary. And I think that I would have to say that, number one, the media is giving folks the information that they want. Because if this wasn't a high-profile case that folks around the world didn't want to know about, then no one would care, no one would watch, and they would report on something else. But the simple fact is, when they report on this, they're overwhelmed with emails and calls, and the ratings are telling them people want to know about this case. Now, I think that cases like this are hugely important for us to analyze and try to come to a motivation on why these individuals do the things that they do. And I'm of the opinion that this is becoming more of a problem, more prevalent in our society. And our look at me, I want what I want when I want it, and I don't care who I have to hurt to get it, but I'm going to get mine.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we've reached a time where murder is often just a means So I think by analyzing this and going over this, I think we can turn this into an educational type of endeavor, as opposed to just a pure sensationalistic trial of the century part two.
Dr. Dale Archer's here. Our last segment, Doc, let's talk about the loons out there that are in love with Yoram. He's talking to the media that he's had marriage proposals and offers for him to father children. And, of course, we've seen it a lot with, you know, the death row inmate that has a fan base. Women go crazy for the guy in the prison stripes. The dark side, I like to call them, that will attack me and attack you in the blogs and on the internet for making comments about Yoram Vandersloot that they don't like. What about those people?
Yeah, that's very interesting, because I did an op-ed for Fox on this case, and some of the comments were, if people like you wouldn't waste your time and write about this, then it would fall out of the public's eye, it wouldn't be an issue.
Right.
But that begs the question that these are people that obviously read what I wrote and then took the time to write a response to it.
Yeah.
So I think that, it's easy to criticize that the media shouldn't talk about it. But the simple point, again, is that these people are reading it. And if they just wanted to say, all right, enough's enough, then they wouldn't be reading the articles. They wouldn't be watching the news reports on it. They would just stop, and that's not what's going on. But I do think that with this particular case, and I want to comment on what you said about the marriage proposals, is that we've reached a point in our society where having any type of media attention, any type of fame, is considered to be a good thing. And 30 years ago, you used to have a talent to become famous. Today, all you need is a crazy life and a reality show, and you're considered famous.
Yeah.
And what's shocking about that is that anyone who has that fame automatically becomes an object of desire and admiration by all of the other folks that are out there.
Yeah. And it's so bizarre, it's so strange, and I don't know, I guess that's what makes the world go round and round, and what keeps a guy like you employed. What are we going to see next from Yoram Vandersloot? This is going to go on, like you say, for a long time yet. It may be the trial of the century, media-wise. What's his next card or rabbit that he's going to pull out of his hat here to try and get attention back to him?
Well, what I think in cases like this is that actions speak louder than words.
Yep.
And so it's not so much as what he's going to say, because I really can't predict what his next statement's going to be. But I think that the one thing that he has proven to be an absolute master at is being able to take a situation that appears to have an answer, i.e. he confessed, and turn that completely upside down and on its head and get everyone in the world talking. So I'm going to predict that here in the next week or so, there's going to be another outrageous statement coming from him. Could be about another victim, perhaps, that he's going to say in another country and start a search over in some other South American country, for example. Could be an accusation about one of his fellow prisoners. Something that he is going to do. It's going to come out of left field. I don't think anyone can predict what it is. But mark my words, he's going to do it.
Absolutely. Dr. Dale Archer, always a pleasure, sir. Thank you.
And I have to give a little plug for a new series that I just started taping. It's for A&E Network, and it's called Blood Work. It's going to be a 20-episode show which looks at true crime cases and has a complete analysis from top to bottom, and I'm doing all the psychiatric analysis on these cases. It's starting in the fall of this year.
Wow, that's excellent. Bloodwork on A&E.
Bloodwork on A&E, yep.
Yeah, check your local listings, as they say in the business, to learn more information about dates and times. Thanks, Doc.
Thank you so much, Zana.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Dr. Dale Archer, and check out his webpage at drdalearcher.com. You'll see him on all the cable news shows, and his new show coming on A&E which sounds like it'll be exciting. And that is Joran Vandersloot's Brain in a Thimble in the last 18 minutes. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dana Fretzer. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we are right back, and I'm getting some flack about Dale Archer's comment about the Holloway case being an accident, and no better person to have on Next Live with me than NBC News analyst, former prosecutor, author, safety expert, and all-around great gal, Robin Sachs. What does Dale Archer mean when he says the Holloway case was an accident?
Well, the second that I hear Dale Archer, who I have nothing but great respect for, and he's no easy sucker when it comes to judging people, and not in a mean way, but in terms of articulating who they are and what they're about. But from a legal point of view, I can see what he's saying is that this isn't necessarily a case where he, keeping Joran Vandersloot, had intended to kill Natalie Holloway. And I think that that was kind of a feeling that many people have had actually from early on. That sounds like it was a case where, you know, at least from his own early admissions and from some of the evidence that we saw and some of the witness statements, that this was a case where Natalie Holloway was extremely intoxicated, and that her well-being and state of mind and impending death may have appeared at the time to be an accident, meaning that she had, you know, drank a ton, and perhaps he panicked and that he threw her overboard somewhere, killed her or something when he panicked, thinking that she had died as a result of his actions, not something he had actually intended to do. Now, I have to say, I can understand the outrage of your listeners, because at this point, when you hear and see the behavior of Joran Vandersloot, who has been nothing but self-serving to himself, and then has had repeated acts of heinous, despicable conduct, including trying to embezzle money from the Holloway family, and also, of course, in the Stephanie Flores death, him being the one and only suspect with a huge amount of evidence, you start to wonder, impossible to fathom that this guy is anything but a cold-blooded killer.
Right.
So I understand and can see both points of view, and I don't necessarily see them as being inconsistent.
No. But doesn't the accident stop? Let's just say allegedly she had been drinking quite a bit. He slips her a roofie. She has some kind of a reaction to it and starts to seizure. Chokes on her own vomit and dies. He panics and throws her in the ocean. Let's just say hypothetically that's what happened. It's no longer an accident as soon as he doesn't do anything to call for help, 911, an ambulance, throws her in the ocean. I think that's what a lot of people are thinking. Vandersloot, and I'll keep saying this, I think told the truth in the hidden video confession where he's rolling along in this video in a vehicle, and he's yapping about and he's smoking dope and he's yapping about being high and stuff. But with that clown, anything's possible. Anyway, Robin Sachs is here. I want to ask you, Robin, the Peruvian judge is saying that Vandersloot's confession is lawful. It wasn't coerced. Are you surprised at that?
No, I'm not surprised at that. At least I'm not surprised at that under American nor common sense standards, and I'm just relieved that the Peruvian court feels the same way. I mean, you know, it's not surprising that when there is a case where there's a confession, a defense strategy is going to be to take any, you know, look for any possible defenses wherever possible. So when there's a confession, of course you're going to do the coerced confession. When there's an eyewitness statement, you're going to question the credibility and believability of an eyewitness person. You're going to have, you know, false confession experts, whatever the case may be. So what the defense attorney is doing is defense attorney 101. The part that I find possible is that the indication from Joran Vandersloot's attorney, not that he's going to appeal the decision, because that doesn't surprise me, but that he is wanting to take the appellate decision beyond that of the Peruvian government and try to appeal to some sort of international tribune. That's where I say, okay, come on. But, you know, make the arguments as you may, Mr. Defense Attorney, but don't do the ridiculous.
But the defense attorneys love the attention, too, because this has got international news attention. It's slowed down a little bit in the last couple of days, but it's going to ramp up again. Some people are saying this will be the trial of the century. I'm not sure about that, but it certainly has an OJ tinge to it, does it not?
It does have an O.J. tinge, but no matter what, the O.J. tinge was O.J. warranted. I mean, you're talking about a case that happened in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You're talking about a case where people knew the people who were involved. There were some racial implications, and not to mention there were a horde of American lawyers who can weigh in on this case. And if you're sitting here watching the news right now on the Jorn Vandersloot, you'll see it's the same cast of characters coming up over and over again, because the fact of the matter is American lawyers don't know all the intricacies of the Peruvian system. I mean, mm-hmm. I couldn't even tell you myself, you know, the level of corruption in Peru, because I don't know. And so, therefore, how true are the laws versus the practices? I don't know. Mexico, I can speak more easily about, because I've had direct relationships with Mexico, as most United States American lawyers. So I don't know.
But as an analyst, now, and as a pundit or whatever you want to call it, someone who comes on and talks about cases, somewhat familiar, you research it, but you're not really there to get all the intricacies. Go back to your DA days. How crazy were you with, or crazy upset were you with some of the lawyers who would come on to talk about cases that you were dealing with?
No, and many of the lawyers are, in fact, like people who are crazy to become their own caricatures of people, no matter what or who they may be. And in this case, the craziest of the characters is Jorn Vandersloot himself. I mean, he really is his own fervor. But the other thing that people don't necessarily realize in this case is how amazing Gene Casares has been in terms of the headline news analysis. I mean, people don't understand that. They think, oh, Gene is someone they've just sent over there as a CNN person. But this is someone who has a command of the Spanish language, who had gained access to the actual jail. And we are actually getting surprising amounts of evidence that are coming forward in this case, almost like the Casey Anthony case, where we see the spillage of documents, you know, continuously. So that's what makes this case a little bit different, is that we are actually having that access that we wouldn't normally get in cases that go overseas.
I couldn't agree more. She's doing a great job with that. Robin Sachs is here. Check out her webpage at robinsachs.com. Has Jorn Vandersloot taken up too much time on the air, though?
Well, I mean, yes and no. Jorn Vandersloot wouldn't take up as much time as he has if there was any other news really going on. But let's face it, I mean, the only other news that's going on in the United States is that, you know, from a celebrity angle, the best that we have is Mel Gibson in restraining orders, and give me a break, that's not news. And you have a little bit, you know, the BP stuff. But other than that, it's summer, and people have the summertime mentality.
Yeah.
And no better time than to resurrect Jorn Vandersloot during a time of slow news where it's going to be constant coverage. So I don't think it's all attributable to the media hawking this up. But, the media does what it needs to do to fill their schedule, too, which is what I am learning from a new legal analyst perspective.
Robin Sachs is here. What's going on with you in the next few days? How busy are you?
You know what? You will see coming out on my blog tomorrow, along those summertime mentalities, that I am adopting Sachs summer hours. But not to say that the world of crime stops in summer, as you know it doesn't, but, you know, the United States government takes a congressional period off between the months of July and August. Oprah takes a hiatus and gives her staff a hiatus. And so I think it's time for us to use this summertime, where we have a little bit of a lull and we have Jorn Vandersloot, that will give us the necessary fix of crime news and a little bit of Casey Anthony and a little Kyron Horam to use this as an opportunity to reconnect with ourselves. So that is what I am doing. I am not traveling at least for another 6 weeks.
Hey, fantastic. Robin Sachs, always a pleasure. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. That's ADA Robin Sachs. And again, Dale Archer didn't mean, I believe, to say that it was just a total accident as far as Vandersloot and Natalie Holloway. could it have been? Nobody will really know exactly what happened, but I think Robin explained it pretty well. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. We're going to be back here in a couple of minutes and continue talking about the Vandersloot investigation, not only in Peru, but in Aruba with private investigator TJ Ward. So we'll take a quick break and we'll be right back. The man behind Investigative Consultants International, Inc., T.J. Ward, is a private investigator, and you'll know him as an investigator who worked for the or works for the Holloway family, trying to find out what happened to Natalie Holloway. And, of course, I have him on the air tonight to talk about the recent developments with Joran Vandersloot, the Holloway case, and his thoughts are behind all of this. TJ Ward, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you very much, Dana.
I'm honored to have you with us. I've covered this, as you know, this story for many years, interviewed the family, interviewed many involved in this case, but for some reason have never interviewed you, so it's great to have you.
Thank you very much.
Joran Vandersloot, you know, we've analyzed the hell out of him. I've had a psychiatrist on tonight talking about him. I've had a DA on tonight talking about him. I've had FBI agents. I've had you name it. I'll never forget a year or two ago interviewing David Koch, the attorney for the Kelpo brothers. And I asked him a question, and he answered it, and then he was mad as hell at me. He wanted me to edit it out of the interview. I asked him this question, TJ. I said, sometimes when investigators are looking into a case and you have three suspects, let's just say hypothetically. Of course, he's an attorney. He's pretty sharp. He knew where I was going with this. And let's just say that one or two of the suspects turn from suspect to informant or turn from suspect to witness. Is there any chance, Mr. Koch, that either one of your clients may turn from suspect to witness? And he answered, you can never say never, or words to that effect. And right then and there, I think he regretted answering that question that way. But something that we haven't heard about with all of this Joran Vandersloot coverage is anything about the Kelpos. They've pretty much flown under the radar, except with us here at Scared Monkeys. Let's talk about that.
Well, first of all, being that Vandersloot is locked up in Peru, the government of Aruba needs to take some new incentive and get some new eyes and new people in line. And one of the first people they need to go to is the Kelpo brothers.
Yep.
Obviously, the communications that the Kelpo brothers had with Joran Vandersloot, and all that we know that they were last seen leaving with Natalie Holloway on May 30th, 2005, it would make a lot of sense if they were going to open the case back up and try to do the right thing. The Kelpo brothers would be one of the first people to be on the radar. I'm a retired criminal investigator and still in the reserves as a captain for a law enforcement agency doing internal affairs, and it doesn't make sense from this investigation from the beginning in 05, what I saw happen, that they had these three boys that left Carlos and Charlie's, and then all of a sudden they take their eyes off of them because two security guards become an issue and take them into custody, and they're an issue for 9 days after incarcerated. Later finding out that about 2.5 hours after they took them in custody, they knew they weren't involved. They kept the focus on them to keep the focus away from these three boys,
yeah.
And I later found out why. It's because the lead investigator, Vanderstraten, was the godfather of Vandersloot and tied to his father, Paulus Vandersloot, very closely in the Minister of Justice in the early 90s. But the Kelpo brothers have to know something or have to know what happened to Natalie. Even if they don't know exactly where she is, they have to know something. And it would make a lot of sense for the government to issue or offer them something
mm-hmm.
to tell the truth. And I'm sure there's other people on the island now that, you know, Vandersloot was a big boy. I mean, 6'4". I've encountered him when I was on the island. And there's people, a lot of people are afraid of him.
Yeah.
And it seems to me if they open this investigation up and do the right thing, investigate the way it should have been, we're probably going to find somebody that's got answers. And the Kelpo brothers are the two people that I would target immediately and bring them in and lean on them. And even if you have to cut them some kind of deal to get the truth and be able to find Natalie and bring closure for the Holloway family would be the right thing.
I totally agree. T.J. Ward is here. He's a private investigator and is working with the Holloway family regarding the disappearance of their daughter, Natalie. We've, again, analyzed the hell out of the corruption, the collusion, the mistakes, the incompetence, and I could keep going with the Reuben law enforcement. I can remember early on covering this story, T.J., and talking to private investigators, people from the FBI, and I used the term investigation 101 when it came to this case. It just wasn't done. It's so sad to see how it happened. Do you have any inkling that it was just incompetence, or, as we've all said, myself included, that this was just totally a cover-up from the Reuben perspective?
Well, I believe it was covered up. I would 99% was covered up. And let me tell you why I know that. When I exposed Van der Straaten on national TV and told them who he was and what he was about and he needed to relieve himself, the following night on Greta Van Susteren, Pito from the Reuben Today newspaper got on Greta Van Susteren and said that law enforcement had a warrant for my arrest. And they had a warrant for my arrest for running around, knocking on doors, acting like a detective. And Greta said, well, wait a minute, isn't that what he's paid to do? He's down here trying to find a Holloway family, and you're telling me there's a warrant for him now for not having a work permit? Well, obviously, you would have to know, before I went on the island, the first time I went on the island, I talked to the government and to the Prime Minister's office about if I needed a work permit or something of that nature, or a license. And they said, no, being you're working for an American, being paid by an American, you're not taking any money from Aruba. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, give me that in writing. So they gave me a letter and told me that I didn't have to have that. And the very next day, after this came out all over the airways, that there was a warrant outstanding for my arrest, Dom Pig the next day apologized and sent me a letter of apology and said he didn't know where it came from. So the lower-ranking law enforcement who may have been connected to Van der Sloot or so on and so forth to cover things up obviously knew that I was being a thorn for them, and they had to get rid of me because I was exposing things, not only with Deepak and Satish, the things that I found out about them, and I won't bore you tonight in the short period of time that we have, but there's things I found out about them that they weren't good little boys either.
No.
But the mere fact that this thing was covered up, was the investigation was totally hampered and was not handled properly. And if the Reuben people, I understand now, are angry. They're angry because they know there might be some validity of what transpired in 2005. And it would seem to me the right thing that the government can do, I think there's new faces and new people, to pick this thing up and go back over what they should have done. And again, the Calpo brothers are going to be a main source of what the communication the Calpo brothers had with Van der Sloot are unbeknown. I know there were wiretaps and that down there at the time, but they were communicating very covertly without people picking up on what they were talking about. And if they would bring them in and lean on them for a while like it did Van der Sloot, the 19 times that they did bring him in and so on and so forth, I think you might see some results.
I couldn't agree more. T.J. Ward is here. I can remember interviewing Jug Twitty and him sharing the story with me about how he and Beth were asked very early on whether or not Natalie suffered from seizures. And, of course, in a traumatic situation like that, you answered the question. But then later on, you kind of put the puzzle together and you wonder, what did they know right from the get-go? And then we see that idiot Van der Sloot all doped up driving along with the hidden camera and him talking about Natalie seizuring. I've said it many times, I think, in all the confessions that he made, the hidden camera confession is probably the most accurate. When you hear things like that, TJ, and all the years of experience that you have, and them asking that question right away, god darn it, they knew right away what happened to that girl.
Well, let me tell you something that is not out on the airways a lot. I had developed some witnesses in Miami that told me about some Colombians in Caracas. And his answer in telling me, and I used a layered voice analysis on this guy when I talked to him to see if he was telling the truth or if he was being deceptive to me, and he was being truthful. But he told me about a boat being brought in from Colombia and these Colombians were paid. And I said, well, who paid them? And he said, the judge.
Mm-hmm.
The judge. I said, what judge? They said, Vandersloot, the boy's father, who's a judge, paid these Colombians to come bring a boat in and take Natalie off the island. That story that happened with Peter DeBries up in the Netherlands is probably the most true story there is, because we believe that there was probably ecstasy or some drugs put in Natalie's drink at Carlos and Charlie's. She was drinking 151. She was drinking heavily the whole time she was there. And the course of the alcohol and the drugs could have pushed her into a seizure when they were on the beach. And I think he panicked, and he called somebody. And there's no doubt to my mind that somewhere along the line his dad got called. And the story that I had brought up, and I turned these tapes over. I had this guy on tape that told me this, and I turned those tapes over to the FBI and told them about this guy telling me about a boat being brought in. Mm-hmm. And Beth and Jug believe there was a boat brought in also.
Yeah.
And it may have been a boat that Vandersloot's father, Paulus Vandersloot, brought in. And there's no doubt in my mind that he's involved.
Exactly.
That he was involved. No doubt in my mind.
Yep, exactly. What's the old saying? If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck. T.J. Ward is here. Let's talk about what's going on now in Peru. We see Vandersloot. We see him manipulating the media like he loves to do. We see the media falling for a lot of what he loves to do, confessing and then recanting and... thank God that they've got more evidence there. Of course, there was plenty of evidence in Aruba. Let's not try and say there wasn't.
There was.
But will the Peruvians handle this better than the Arubans? They have to.
The evidence is overwhelming against Vandersloot and what transpired on the 30th of this year. None whatsoever. You know, he just filed a habeas corpus and to say certain things happened. That he was illegally done this and he was illegally done that and the computer and so on and so forth. And his habeas on Friday was denied by the courts. And it would be very unlikely for a Supreme Court or another higher court, unless there was judicial misconduct or a oblivious mistake made in that courtroom or in a proceeding so far, in order to overturn what already has been said to keep him incarcerated. There is no doubt in my mind he will stay incarcerated. The laws in Peru are a little bit different than they are in Aruba, and he doesn't have that cushion in Peru as he had in Aruba with his family there, his father being part of the justice system, his father's influence, and now his father's gone away. That's why he's going to start probably having problems in Aruba. I've seen his Facebook page, and some of his Facebook pages, him talking about that he was through with Aruba, he was going to go to Peru and live there till he could get his store, his coffee shop back up in Thailand, which we know is a cover for whatever else he was doing in Thailand. But he was through with Aruba. And now that he's got the discomfort of Peru, of what's going on, Aruba is very inviting back to go back to. But rest assured, those people in Peru are not going to turn him over to Aruba or anybody else until he's adjudicated and spent his time for killing Stephanie Flores, and especially with the political power in Peru with her father as being connected as he is. Rest assured, he's going to face the music there.
Oh, yeah, his goose is cooked. There's no doubt about it. T.J. Ward is here for the next few minutes. Longtime investigator, you go out and you do a job. No matter what you're doing, you want to get answers. You want to put the puzzle together, so to speak. How frustrating, and this is kind of a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How frustrating is it for you to see Vandersloot in Peru and to know that he could have been nailed in Aruba?
Well, it's very sad. Dana, it's very, very sad that another victim and another family has to go through the tragedy the same way the Holloway family went through for his shenanigans. And it's got to come to an end. And I believe that he's got his head in the noose right now. He's not going to be able to get out of. And I'm real surprised that he's even got representation in Peru,
yeah,
even though we know that lawyers take oaths to practice law. But the political pressure from this lawyer representing him is probably overwhelming. But he needs to come clean. He's not going anywhere, and he needs to tell the truth for one time in his life. and give the Aruban authorities, when they show up or whatever they do, and give them some answers about where Natalie is, and let the Holloway family take their daughter home or, and lay her to rest so they can get some peace of mind. There's nothing worse than losing your child. Nothing. And they have been living with this for 5 years, and now another family has to live the same thing that they've gone through with a much more tragic thing that we already know about in the manner in which Stephanie Flores died and how she was beaten to death and how this guy has done this. Unbeknown what the real answers about Natalie Holloway are and what transpired to him. What goes through my mind was Natalie in a comatose state when they did something to her or disposed of her, or was she completely dead? Yeah. Because we know from that interview that he did, and he was set up by Peter DeBries. He testifies, in the car, not knowing he was being taped, yeah, that he was doing CPR on her and trying to shake her and wake her. So we don't know if she was completely out of it or whether she was dead at the time or they did something with her or what transpired. It's only go through our mind right now to figure out what may have transpired. But he knows. He knows what happened. He was there, and he needs to come clean and tell the truth.
Absolutely. Well said. Private Investigator T.J. Ward, thank you, sir. We'll have you back on again soon.
Okay. Thank you, Dennis.
Take care.
Good night.
Bye-bye. That's T.J. Ward, and, telling it like it is, and I agree with everything he said. That's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. Make sure and check out our webpage at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you can pick up the show live, listen to podcasts of past shows, daily commentaries, and, of course, don't forget the creme de la creme of all the blogs out there, scaredmonkeys.com. Good night.
Been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.